I do very much appreciate that which has gone before, that very good, humble, and fervent prayer, and the wonderful, heartfelt song service that we had this morning. I'd like to go this morning to a very familiar book. It's the book of Zephaniah. And if you don't know where Zephaniah is, it's between two other very famous books that start with H, named Habakkuk and Haggai. So I'm sure all of you know where that is. While you're looking for Zephaniah, I will give an introduction to the things we'd like to bring to your mind this morning. Sometimes we, in our life, we go through different seasons, we go through different scenes, and unfortunately, our vision and our mind stays sort of directly in front of us. Sometimes we have blinders on, we just see where the next step is. And sometimes life is so busy and so difficult that it seems like that's all we can do, is just see the next place to put our foot. But from time to time, it behooves us, I think, in particular certain high moments of our life, to look up and to view things perhaps in a way that we don't always see them. And in Zephaniah chapter 3, I believe we get a very good picture of how the Lord looks at a scene like we have right now. And if we can look at it in this way, the way that God does, not only will it better frame our minds when we're in a scene like this, but it'll help better frame our minds when we leave a scene like this and go back out into the world for a little while. So in Zephaniah chapter 3, and I'm, for the sake of time, going to have to pick up reading in the middle of a thought, but I'm going to begin in verse 12. Zephaniah 3 and verse 12, he says, "I will also leave in the midst of thee an afflicted and poor people, and they shall trust in the name of the Lord. The remnant of Israel shall not do iniquity, nor speak lies, neither shall a deceitful tongue be found in their mouth, for they shall feed and lie down, and none shall make them afraid. Sing, O daughter of Zion, shout, O Israel, be glad and rejoice with all the heart, O daughters of Jerusalem. The Lord hath taken away thy judgments. He has cast out thine enemy. The King of Israel, even the Lord, is in the midst of thee. Thou shalt not see evil any more. In that day it shall be said to Jerusalem, Fear thou not, and to Zion, Let not thy hands be slack. The Lord thy God in the midst of thee is mighty. He will save. He will rejoice over thee with joy. He will rest in his love. He will joy over thee with singing. I will gather them that are sorrowful for the solemn assembly, who are of thee, to whom the reproach is to bear a burden. Behold, in that time I will undo all that afflict thee, and I will save her that halteth, and gather her that was driven out, and I will get them praise and fame in every land where they have been put to shame. At that time will I bring you again, even in the time that I gather you, for I will make you a name and a praise among all people of the earth, when I turn back your captivity before your eyes, saith the Lord." Now, I'm not planning to deal with every verse of this. The verse that we'd like to center on is verse 17, but I read all that to set a stage that the Lord has showed us a place. He showed us a scene and a situation. And in this situation, there's some things we can expect to find. One of the things we can expect to find is about our own condition. What has the Lord left for us? We're an afflicted and a poor people. Now, that doesn't sound very pleasant. You say, well, this isn't starting off very good. Friends, being afflicted and being poor is not necessarily a state of our physicality. It's not a state of how our health is. It's really a state of mind, and it's a state of being that we understand about ourselves. If you were to ask the average person on the street, on the job, in your community, hey, what do you think about yourself? They're going to tell you all these good things about themselves. They're not going to tell you all the bad things. I mean, when you write a resume, are you putting all your failures on your resume or putting all your successes? I mean, you're told, I mean, I've taken resume writing classes, and they say this over and over again, toot your own horn, because nobody else is going to toot it for you. Well, friends, that might work in the world, But to quote Elder Bill Walden, the things that will grow the world will kill the church. And the things that will grow the church will kill the world. Because we have here a situation where we don't toot our own horn. Because there ain't nothing to toot about. There's nothing worth tooting in our own natural frame. But when we come to understand in our spirit and in our heart that by nature I am nothing and less than nothing, that the very best that I have is altogether vanity, we feel in ourselves to be afflicted, we feel to be poor, and we're in a position to receive the good news that Zephaniah now gives about the Lord. And this place that we have, the Lord has come, the Lord has redeemed, the Lord has saved, the Lord has turned back captivity. All these expressions are wonderful, but how does God look at this? How does God approach a time like this? Let me go back and read verse 16 and 17. In verse 16 he says, "In that day it shall be said to Jerusalem, fear thou not, and to Zion, let not thy hands be slack." We're told in this day to not be afraid. We're told in this day, don't be lazy. Don't let our hands be slack. Why? Because the Lord thy God is in the midst of thee. The very first thing that he wants us to know is the Lord our God is in the midst of thee. Now, in the midst is something that we don't use oftentimes in our vocabulary anymore, but it literally means to be right there in the middle of. I mean, whenever you come to the house of God, I tell you this, Jesus Christ is just as close to you as he is to me. He's not near one and not near another. He's right there in the midst of us. He tells us in Matthew 18, "For where two or three are gathered together in my name, there am I in the midst." And friends, it should be our joy and our goal to be right there in the midst with him. I know people who said, "Well, I just don't belong. Well, I'm not worthy." There was a brother who, I mean, he was about as faithful as any member we had at the church I pastored in Georgia. And when I first moved there, he said, "I want to talk to you." And I said, "Okay." He said, "Listen, I went to the mat with Cecil Daugherty. I went to the mat with Sam Bryant. I went to the mat with Ricky Harker. And I'm going to go to the mat with you too." And I said, "About what?" He goes, "I'm not worthy to be a member of this church, and that's the end of it." And I said, "Okay." And I walked away. And he said, "Aren't you going to say anything?" I said, "Brother, what is there to say? If men like Cecil Daugherty, Sam Bryant, and Ricky Harker can't change your mind, I know I can't." And that brother was there every Sunday. He was one of the first ones there. He was more faithful than some of the members. And yet he would never, ever consider joining the church. Friends, that's kind of being on the outside looking in. That's sort of understanding that I love this place, but I don't belong to this place. But I'll tell you this, by the grace of God, we do belong to this place. The only way that we're worthy for a place like this is for the same reason we're worthy for a place like heaven, because the Lord has made us worthy by his grace. And when he comes, he doesn't come, friends, for us to just sort of stand on the outside and sort of wave at him. He comes right here in the middle of us. And when he comes right here in the middle of us, friends, he doesn't come with an anxious heart. He doesn't come with a fearful spirit. He comes with joy. He comes and he's uplifted, friends. Can you imagine that? When we preach with the Holy Ghost sent down from heaven, the Lord doesn't just come like, "Well, I guess I'll go meet with him." He comes with joy right here in our midst to broken vessels like this. I mean, sometimes I'll admit the preacher wakes up on Sunday morning and he doesn't feel like, you know, church. Does that happen to you too? It happens to me. I mean, there's an old story about a wife who went to wake up her husband one day and she said, "Honey, you got to get up. We got to go to church." He goes, "I don't feel like it." She said, "Honey, you got to get up." He said, "Nobody there cares what I think. Nobody there wants to do anything I say. Nobody listens to me. Nobody's going to miss me if I'm gone." She said, "Honey, you have to go. You're the preacher." I mean, that's how preachers are sometimes. And sometimes we wake up and we feel all right, and then the children open their mouths and we don't feel all right. I mean, it happens. I mean, we have those moments where you're driving to church, and maybe y'all don't have this problem. Y'all don't have as far to drive as I do, most of you. But, I mean, you're about halfway there, and you're like, "If I hear one more cross word, you're going to be quiet for the rest of the day." It happens. But when the Lord comes down and meets with people like us, it's not with cross words. It's not with a sorrowful spirit. The Lord in the midst of thee is mighty. And when he comes, he has power to help. He has power to bless. He has power to uplift, which is why the psalmist says in Psalm 122, he says, "I will lift up mine eyes into the hills." Why? Because there's where my help comes from. And so the Lord in the midst of thee is mighty. He will save. Now that's a curious expression when you don't understand what we, I believe, have been blessed to understand. The Lord doesn't come down to a scene like this. He doesn't come down to Jerusalem and to Zion with the intent of blessing more people to get to heaven. That's not his purpose in being here. One of the most special things about what we understand the Scriptures to teach is that we can identify and distinguish what is both eternal and positional, as being done by God through Christ, and what is conditional and timely that is upon us to do in our lives. And friends, when the Lord comes, He comes with all intent and all purpose to save and to bless. Now, how does He do that? He does it in a multitude of ways, but the clearest example from Scripture is, I trust, by what's going on right now. The Lord hath chosen, as Paul says in 1 Corinthians 1 and 22, He hath chosen by the foolishness of preaching to save them that believe. Now, we need to understand that this salvation is obviously not to get us to heaven, because three verses prior, in 1 Corinthians 1 and verse 18, He says, for the preaching of the cross is to them that perish foolishness, but unto us which are saved, it is the power of God. This is not to get somebody saved. This is for the people that are already saved. These are for people who already are children of God. And friends, when it comes to our position that we have in Christ, there is a condition that we find ourselves in when we need saving, when we need blessing. I mean, when Peter was sinking in the Sea of Galilee and he said, Lord, save me, he didn't have heaven on his mind. He had drowning on his mind. And the Lord, by His grace, put His hand down and pulled him up out of the water and brought him back up in the boat. Friends, there's times in our lives we don't have heaven on our mind. We've got drowning on our mind. We have situations where we just think, I just can't make it. I mean, it's up to here and I just can't see the horizon. And friends, when the Lord, by His grace, comes walking on the very tops of our troubles and reaches His hand down and pulls us back up out of the waves and sets us in the boat of Zion, and we're able to not only see our way clear, but in that moment, sometimes a storm ends just like that. Sometimes we're at land just like that. And it just seems like all that we have been going through, it just seems like nothing. Because the Lord's with us, He's in our presence, and He has come and He has saved us all over again. So that's one way the Lord saves us, is through the foolishness of preaching. But you know, He also saves us in another way, that whenever we come together, we're with people that we understand. People that speak our language. People that understand the situations that we're going through. The Apostle Paul, in closing Hebrews chapter 11, talked about a whole group of people that lived and died by faith. And they died in faith, but when they died, they hadn't yet received the promise. And God had left some better thing for us than they had. The better thing that we have today than anybody like Moses or David or Solomon or any of those Old Testament patriarchs had, is that we don't have just the promise of Christ, we have the story of the reality of Christ. We don't look forward in anticipation to redemption. We look backward upon redemption that has already occurred. And that's why when we come together, Paul says, wherefore, seeing we also are encompassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which doth so easily beset us, and run with patience the race which is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and the finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before Him endured the cross, despising the shame thereof. For consider Him who endured such contradiction of sinners against Himself. You know, there's a lot of people that we could talk to and talk with that if you tell them about the story of Christ, they'll give you part of it. But friends, it wasn't just that He endured the cross, but for the joy that was set before Him, He endured the cross and despised the shame thereof. We understand that what happened there was accomplished. What happened there was victorious. I'm not looking, friends, for Christ to come back the second time to get done what He couldn't do the first time. I'm looking for Christ to come back the second time to manifest that He already did get it done. He's not coming back, friends, to maybe tie all the knots, loose ends up in knots. He's coming back to say, it's a reality. I'm here. And whenever that happens, friends, even His enemies are going to have no really recourse. I mean, their knee is just going to hit the deck. They're not going to submissively bow. They're not going to voluntarily bow themselves and declare that Jesus Christ is the Lord. They're going to have to do it because the reality is there in front of them.
that he who has all power, he who has all authority, he who has all honor is verily here and has verily manifested himself. But friends, we don't have to wait for that day to understand that. We can come with like-minded people and tell this story and talk about these things. And when we do, Christ in the midst of us declares with us that, yes, I have come. Yes, I have saved, but I have salvation today. And the salvation that he has today brings us up out of the throes of sorrow. It brings us up out of the mire of misery. And it blesses us, friends, to be seated with him for a little while and to look upon things that are not of this world. So the Lord in the midst of thee is mighty. He will save. He will rejoice over thee with joy. This one amazes me. And the reason it amazes me is because there's a lot in my life. Let me back up. There's a lot about me in my life that's not worth joying in. I mean, I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, but how many of you have failed him this week? I really don't want to ask this question, but how many times have you failed him this week? How many times have I let him down? How many times has he given me the ability to do better, and I haven't done better? How many times has he given me sufficient grace for today, and I've squandered it, and have to ask for him to bless me tomorrow to do better? He knows that about me. He knows that my study is poor. He knows that my prayer life is terrible. He knows that my compassion is lagging. He knows that my heart wanders, and he knows my mind goes astray. And I hope if all of us are honest, we would admit we're an afflicted and poor people who feel the same way. But friends, when he comes down with joy. It wasn't just joy that brought him 2,000 years ago to put away our sins. It's joy that brings him today. Because friends, he looks forward to being with us. Can you believe that? He looks forward to being with us. I don't look forward to being with me. I mean, I've said before that if everybody in the church was like me, I'd probably find another place to go to church. I mean, I ask myself that question all the time. What if everybody in the church was like me? That's a sobering thought. But I'll tell you this, what makes it all right is that when everybody comes with all of our problems and with all of our different situations, the Lord comes and it's somehow all right. Because when he comes with joy and he rejoices over us with joy. That means that when the Lord comes, there is a situation that he finds pleasant, a situation that he is uplifted by. Because friends, when we come in, we're told in, I believe it's Luke chapter 15, in the story about the lost sheep, when the man went out to seek the one sheep that was lost, it says that he rejoiced more over that one sheep that was found than over the 99 that never left. He says, so likewise, there is joy in heaven over one sinner that repenteth. Now, sometimes we get a little down because we're a small bunch. We are, as I mentioned last Sunday, in Luke chapter 12, he says that, fear not, little flock, for it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. There's things about us that we lament sometimes, that we're small, that we're little, that we're poor, that we're afflicted. And yet, if just one of us repents, what happens? There's joy in heaven. And I believe that flows from the very throne itself, from the very being, if you allow me to use earthly language, from the very heart of God himself. That the very heart of God himself joys and rejoices when one of us repents. Now what about a whole congregation? I believe that's an abundance of joy. What about a group of people that know, though we know we're sinners, we know we've come short of the glory of God, what happens when we come together and ask the Lord fervently in our spirit to bless? I believe there's an abundance of joy that comes down, joy that's unspeakable and full of glory. And when the Lord comes and rejoices over us with joy, he has come to meet with the people who we know we're broken, we know we're frail, and yet he sees us attempting to serve God. And we'll get to some of that in a minute. So he rejoices over us with joy. Notice this next one. He shall rest in his love. This is a curious expression because if you consider his love, there's a lot about it that doesn't, in our mind, equate to rest. His love provoked a lot of work. A lot of work that, quite frankly, had he not done, he'd have still been God. His love is what provoked him to send his Son into this world to live as one of us, to be as one of us, to die for us, and to be raised again for us. It's his love that provokes him to bless us with things like his word. things like His church, things like His Spirit and His counsel. It's His love that provokes Him to do all these things for us simply because He loves us. That doesn't sound a whole lot like rest. Because in our mind, rest isn't how it is in God's mind. Rest in our mind a lot of times equates to sleep. Now, y'all give me a minute on this. Sleep and rest ain't the same thing. You can get all the sleep you want, but if there ain't no rest, it ain't going to be good. And if you get some rest, even if you don't get much sleep, it's going to be all right. Some of y'all been after me for years to get more sleep. I get plenty of rest. Thank you very much. That's why I can sleep hard for 3 or 4 hours and I'm done. I mean, I think I get better rest in 3 to 4 hours than some people get in 8 or 10. That's just my own personal opinion. And I seem like I'm doing all right. That's why I'm so cheerful. Moving on. My point is this. Rest and sleep are not the same thing. When the Lord rested on the seventh day, He didn't go to sleep. Why did He rest? He rested because He just ceased. There was nothing else to do when it came to creation, so He just stopped. The Lord rests in His love because there's a sense of His love that has reached an accomplishment. I mean, there is no need for Him to love us so much that more sin has to be put away. It's already put away. There's no reason, friends, for His love to provoke Him to do something that's already been done. When Christ said it is finished in John 19 and 30, no matter what any man, devil, or demon says, it's still finished. And nobody understands that better than God. And He rests in that. That's why, friends, when He comes down and joys with us, one of the things that He joys in, I believe, is the message, it is finished. I believe He joys in that. You know why? Because it describes all glory to Him. And it talks of an accomplishment that He knows He fulfilled. I love the description of this in Luke chapter 9 when Jesus is on the Mount of Transfiguration and He talks with Moses and Elijah. That Luke 9 is the only account of the Mount of Transfiguration that tells us what they talked about. They spoke of His decease, which He should accomplish at Jerusalem. They were speaking of something in the future that would be accomplished. We come together and speak about something that was accomplished in the past for us. And because of that, God is not only resting in His love, but He's joying in that rest that He knows that it's done. But you know, He also rests in His love in this way. There is not a situation in life that we can point to that the Lord has not properly equipped us for. There is no situation in life that we can say, well, the Lord just didn't quite give me enough faith. Or the Lord just didn't quite give me enough love or joy or peace or long-suffering. The Lord knows in Himself that what is required, He has provided. The Lord knows that what we stand in need of, He has granted. He knows that whatever grace is needed has been sufficiently given unto us. And He rests in that. You know why He rests in that? Because He knows that He's a good provider. He knows He's a good sustainer. And He knows, friends, that He's a good father and a good husband and a good brother. And God rests in that. And when He comes, He is resting in His own love while we're here. We sometimes speak of the things that we talk about, that angels desire to look into, that the prophets of old have desired to look into. But friends, God's not desiring to look into these things. He gave these things. But God's, if you'll allow me to say this, looking forward to hearing these things all over again. He's looking forward to us talking about these things all over again. He's looking forward, friends, to us thanking Him for the love that He's given unto us, for thanking Him for the goodness that He's bestowed upon us. And He rests in that. And that's why when He saw the travail of His soul there in Isaiah 53, He was satisfied then, and He's satisfied now. And He'll be satisfied tomorrow, and He'll be satisfied for all eternity. So He rests in His love. The very last thing of verse 17 says that He will joy over thee with singing. If there was ever a place that I thought probably didn't need to have to hear this, y'all would be that place. Y'all understand singing very well. Now, it was a struggle when I was at Cool Springs because one of the things that I labored with at Cool Springs, and I would say this if they were all here, they heard me say it for 12 years almost, or 11 years, is that when we would start the service, about 1/3 of the total congregation would be there when we started. So 2/3 of the people showed up somewhere in the middle of singing to somewhere in the middle of preaching. It was either from 15 to 40 minutes late. And it was the same people. Some of them lived a mile down the road. And I thought, we started at 11 o'clock in the morning. You live a mile down the road and you got here at 11:35. How is that possible? The reason it's possible is because it's poor planning. You haven't prepared. You haven't dedicated. you're engaged in other things. But some of them, and I had to fight this notion while I was there, some of them said, well, I just missed song service. And I said, yeah. And they said, well, it was just song service. And I said, friends, song service is a very vital, important aspect of worship. And it's something that the Lord takes very seriously. Because when he comes down, and he's in the midst of us, and he's resting in his love, friends, he's not silent. He is not silent when he is here. We sometimes talk about the voice of my beloved. We sometimes talk from the book of Song of Solomon about all the things that he says to us. Friends, we may not hear those things audibly, but they're being declared and they're being spoken while we're here. Now, I want to get to that in a minute, but when he comes, he joys over us with singing. Sometimes people look at our singing and they look at our manner of worship and they say, well, that's kind of plain. Well, that's not all that good. I'm going to tell you something, friends. What makes our singing as pretty as it is isn't because we're trained vocalists. It isn't because we know all the notes. It isn't, friends, because we have somehow ascribed or attained to a level that we are professionally better than other people. What makes our singing great is because our husband comes and sings with us. What makes our singing pretty, friends, is because we're not singing alone. Not just with one another, but we're singing with him. Because when he comes, it's his voice that says, rise up, my love, my fair one, and come away. He tells us, for lo, the winter is past and gone. And the sound of the turtle is heard in our land. He comes and his voice is skipping upon the mountains and leaping upon the hills. And when he comes, his face shows himself behind our wall, looking through the lattice at us. And when he comes, he is not just staring at us. He's singing unto us. And when he sings, friends, it's with voice of comfort. It's with a voice of love that causes us to forget about life for a little while. I'll tell you, there's nothing that will drain away and melt away the icebergs of life like a good old-fashioned, heartfelt song service with our husband in the midst, singing over us and joying over us with singing. And friends, he's not, again, singing because he has to. He's joying in this. He rejoices in this. It's something he looks forward to. It's something that he desires to do. Isn't that amazing? He desires to do this. He desires to come down. He desires to meet with his people, and he desires to sing. Now, if that is how God looks at a scene like this, how is it that I should look at a scene like this? For the time that I have left, may we look at this from our perspective. May we look at this and how we should view this. That if the Lord is in the midst of us, why is there any reason to be afraid? That's why it says, fear not and be glad. Fear not and be glad. Why? Because the Lord is in the midst of thee. And friends, he's not just in the midst of us here, but he shows himself here in a manifest way to prove to us once again, I'm with you always, even unto the end of the world. And friends, we can leave a place like this, having come to it, maybe a little cold, maybe a little worn down, maybe a little bowed over, and know that the Lord still loves us, the Lord is still on our right hand, the Lord still has a hold of us, and because of that, I can go back out into a cold, dark, and dreary world, and I can understand once again that even though I'm not here, the Lord is still where? In my midst, with me, holding my hand. And because of that, friends, we should not be afraid. The psalmist says, the Lord is my light, and the Lord is the strength of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? Because if you consider the person that we have that walks with us, that stands with us, that guides us and directs us, friends, who will never let us down, who doesn't just not forsake us, he never even leaves us. And because of that, friends, we can have joy and consolation in this world that the Lord is in our midst and the Lord's love is ever present unto us. So the Lord is in the midst. And it says that he will save us. I ask you this question, where would you be today, I'm not talking about the salvation of heaven, but where would you be without the timely blessings of this world that the Lord gives unto us? The blessings that, if you just take heaven out of it, I still can't measure them up. I still can't count them up. I mean, we talked about the salvation of the gospel. I don't know where I would be without that. But what about the salvation of just the church itself? That as it was prayed this morning, we have a home, a refuge, a sanctuary in this old world. What about the salvation of family? To have good family, to have godly family, to be raised in a good home, to be blessed to try to raise a good home. What about the blessing of a good nation? That all my life, I've had liberty that I didn't fight for, and I have freedom that I didn't win, but was given unto me. What about the blessing of good health? To not only have the strength and the ability to serve God in His house, but have the strength and the ability to take care of your family, to have health, to be able to do things that are good for others. What about just the very basics? I have never, ever in my life been close to starving. Ever. Not all people can say that. But that's never been my case. I've never wondered, friends, if I was going to have a home, because I've always had a roof over my head. And I heard a preacher say one time, and I've been robbing it and stealing it ever since, he said, sometimes we say, thank God for being able to get out of bed this morning, but we forgot to say, thank God for having a bed to get up out of. Sometimes the very basic things that just go so unnoticed, the Lord has saved us in so many ways. And if He has been with us, and He is with us, what is there to think that He won't be with us, that He won't save, that He won't bless in any day, in any future, in any circumstance that we have? So the Lord has saved us, and the Lord will continue to save us. And the Lord joys or rejoices over us with joy. I know I've said this, but I'm going to say it again. It amazes me, and I actually said it on the way to church this morning. It amazes me when people show up to the greatest place in all the world, and they act like they've got a problem with their liver, or they've got an impacted molar or something. I mean, there was a sister, she's in heaven now, bless her heart. I never saw her smile in church, ever. And it wasn't just that she was stone-faced, she was just like this. I mean, it was grumpy. And I thought, we're in the best place in the world. Yes, if you want to know what happened on the way to church, there were two of my children. I won't tell you which ones, but they're the two youngest. And they were just back at each other, back and forth. And I finally said, we're going to the greatest place in the world. Why are you acting like this? But sometimes, friends, I have to ask myself, I'm going to the greatest place in the world. Why am I acting like that? You know what the Lord told us through the writings of the Apostle Paul in Philippians 4 and verse 4? He says, rejoice in the Lord. How often? Always. And just to make the point as effectual as he can, and I say again, rejoice. Whether we're feeling good or feeling bad, it doesn't matter. Because Paul would go on later in Philippians 4 to say he's been hungry, he's been full, he's been abounded, he's been abased, he's understood all the situations of life in the spectrum. But he still says, rejoice in the Lord always. And I say again, rejoice. He told the Thessalonians in 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 16, he says, rejoice evermore. In other words, no matter what the situation, no matter what the season, why? Because the things that God has done, the things that God is doing, and the things that God has promised that He will do cannot and will not fail. They stand for sure, they stand forever. And because of that, whatever happens here, it's just temporary. It's just transitory. The things that we go through, they're just for a little while. But the things that God has done will endure not only in this life, but in the life to come. Not only in this world, but in the hereafter, forever and evermore. Because of that, friends, when He comes and He rejoices over us with joy, may we rejoice with joy. With the same kind of joy that He has, because if He is glad to be with a people like us, I tell you, how much more should a people like us be glad to be with a God like He is, who has come and done these things unto us? And then this one is one that is special to me when it says that He will rest in His love. We are able to rest in His love. We're able to cease from our own labors as God did from His. We are able, friends, for a little while to put off this world and to think solely upon what God has done for us. Now, I want you to consider that just as God's resting was not a... that He went to sleep, and just as His rest was not a ceasing forevermore, it was just that that was accomplished, there is a sense in which God's resting His love, there's an exercise attached to it because He still comes down. There's an exercise to it because He still sings. There's an exercise to it because He still uplifts us and cheers our heart. And there's an exercise to us resting in God's love. Paul says in 1 Timothy 4 and about verse 8, and most of you know the first part of that verse, but let's do the whole verse. He says, for bodily exercise profiteth little. That's generally where that verse is ended. That's not the end of the verse. For bodily exercise profiteth little, but godliness is profitable to all things, having promise of the life which now is and that which is to come. Just as we have a rest in God's love, there's an exercise attached to it. It's a labor of love that rest is attached to. Because friends, you can't come here and not put forth some labor. You can't sing and not put forth some labor. You can't pray and not put forth some labor. I can't preach without laboring. I mean, it's just the nature of it. But we labor while resting in His love. One of the things that I do not have to worry about when I meet with God is wondering whether all of God's children are going to get to heaven. I never have to worry about that. I mean, we're a blessed people that we can lay our heads down at night and say, thank God it's not in my hands. Thank God I didn't have to take care of it. Thank God nobody's going to burn forever for what I did or didn't do today. I can rest in that. I can lay my head down in that. I can come to the house of God, and while this is not what I want, I can come to the house of God and make a mess of a sermon, and it's not going to damn anybody for all eternity because I made a mess of the sermon. That's a great thing. I mean, I don't know how these other guys deal with the stress of it. I mean, what if they mess up? Who might burn if they mess up? I mean, I don't know how people can go on vacation. I mean, how many people are going to burn because you went on vacation? We can rest in God's love while laboring in His kingdom, which is why the Apostle Paul says in 2 Thessalonians chapter 1 about some people who were fervent in faith, who were patient in tribulation, who had done all these various things. He says in verse 7 of 2 Thessalonians 1, he says, and to you who are troubled, rest with us. One of the things that I want God's children to know and understand is that we have a rest that this world knows nothing of. And if Washington goes away tomorrow, we can still rest in His love. If a lot of our natural blessings go away, we can still rest in His love. Not just having promise of the life which is to come, but the life which now is. That He's not just going to be with us to take us to heaven. He's going to be with us every single day of our life. Friends, that's an exercise that we must go through to understand and tell ourselves and remind ourselves and have the Spirit of God come and remind us again that God is on our side and there's no man that can take that from us. Because the devil will want to whisper in our ear and say, well, there's no way that God could love you. There's no way you could be one of His. Look what you've done. Look how bad you've been. And friends, everything he accuses me of, I know it's true. Because I saw it happen because I was the one that did it. But I thank God that we can go to a place like the Word of God, come to a place like the house of God and listen to something like the gospel of God and understand that He's put all that away. He's blotted all that out. And because of that, we can rest. And look upon Him with admiration and joy in what He has done for us. You know, a lot of times, I'll just say this since it's about to happen. And I would say this if Brother David was here. When I go to a wedding, there comes a point in that wedding when I am looking in the very different place that everybody else is looking. Because when they sound the notes and everybody rises up, they turn around to look at her as she comes down the aisle. I'm the only one who doesn't. I look up there at him because in that moment I better see something in his face that shows me how much this means to him. And I can tell you, friends, that when I come to the house of God, there's not notes at play and not everybody rises when I come in. But when as a portion of the bride I come in, I look up and there's a look on his face that means something to me. It tells me by just his look, you're my love. You're my beloved. You're the choice one of her that bear you. And you're the only one. Because my beloved is one. And I look at him and that face that he has and his countenance shining down upon me. And as the bride said, that he is altogether lovely. And friends, when I come in, I can sit with him and rest with him. Because yes, we're declaring things about him. But at the very same time, he's declaring unto us, once again, how much he loves us. Whether it's by voice, whether it's by spirit, or whether it's by an eye of faith, just seeing his face glow by being around us. Friends, in that moment when the bride and the groom meet together, it means something to him. And so should it mean to us. This exercise is not in vain. Friends, I realize that nothing that we do has any bearing on heaven, but it has a lot of bearing on our life. And it's not in vain. Don't let anybody ever tell you that this exercise is in vain. It's not. That's why the Apostle Paul in the book of Hebrews talked about God not being unfaithful to forget your labor of love and your work of righteousness, because it's not in vain. Friends, this labor of love and this work of righteousness, it has not been, nor will it ever be in vain. And yes, that even includes on Saturday afternoon of an associational meeting when Elder Brushstacker gets up and doesn't preach a lick. And then he's followed by Elder Preach-a-Lick, who's followed by Can't Preach His Way Out of a Bag. I mean, when those moments happen, it's still not in vain. When Brother sings them awful slow and sings them awful low, leads a song, it's not in vain. Don't look at me crazy. I know you felt the same way at big meetings. I mean, it happens. I mean, when someone leads a song by a tune that you didn't know they were going to lead it to, it's not in vain. When somebody says the wrong thing, because we do, does the wrong thing, because we do, this labor is not in vain. Means something to Him, should mean the world to us as well, that we rest in His love with Him here in this place. And again, you don't need this, but it's part of the lesson. He joys over us with singing. So should we joy with Him in singing. The verse that I've been trying not to quote up until this point, because I wanted to save it till now, is Colossians 3 and verse 23. He says, "And whatsoever ye do, do it heartily as unto the Lord." Friends, the word heartily means with spirit, with fervency, with all that we have. Because there's times when we just don't feel like it. There's times when we don't want to give it our all. Friends, whether we feel like it or not, He's worth our all. He's worth everything we've got. He's worth me giving of my, not just my body, but my soul, but also my body. Not just of my time, but all of who I am. The Apostle Paul said to a church that was the Corinthian church, not a really great one, he says that I wanted you. This church had all these problems. He did this. I did this because I wanted you. I'm not your own, not what you had, but you. I wanted to be with you. I wanted to labor with you. I wanted to minister with you. And friends, if God sees fit to come down and want to be with us, with everything that we have, whether in song, whether in prayer, whether in voice, or whether in deed, let it be such, friends, that when He looks at us, we're putting forth all the effort that we have, all the energy that we have. Because, friends, He is worthy of so much more than I am able to give. May I give all that I can. May I give it my all. So when people look at us, they see a people who don't go to church because they have to. They see a people who go to church because they love it, because they enjoy being here and being and meeting with our God. To see people who go through life not dragging their feet like, "Oh, I got to do this," but going through life with joy, because the same God that is with us here is with us out there. A people that not only rest in His love here, but when all the trials and all the fires of life come, when all the sorrows and all the plagues come upon us in our life, we can still sit down and look upon His face with righteousness and holiness and joy and say, "The Lord is on my side. I'm not afraid. The Lord is still with me. I'm not going to be distressed. And in this world I may have tribulations and I may have persecutions, but I am of good cheer." Why? Because He has overcome the world, not just for that which is to be, but that which is for right now. Which is why He says at the close of this, "At that time will I bring you again, even in the time that I appointed you, even that time will I gather you, for I will make you a name and a praise among all people of the earth. When I turn back your captivity before your eyes, saith the Lord." Friends, I thank God that He has turned our captivity back from our own eyes. I'm thankful that while we know that we're sinners, we can say we're sinners that are redeemed and bought by the blood of the Lamb. And if we have that manner of life, not just within these walls, but every day of our life, I can tell you what the result's going to be. There's going to be a name about it. There's going to be people talking about it. You don't have to toot your own horn to make this happen. All it is just being different. The world will always notice what is different. They may not like it, but they'll notice it. Why is it, friends, that we should be ready to give an answer to every man that asks us? Because there's something different they want to know about. There's something they see in us that they don't see in others. That how could we act this way? How could we be this way? And friends, we have the greatest story that has ever happened in this world. A story that keeps getting told here. A story that no matter how many times I hear it, it lifts me up like nothing else ever can or would. And it's a place, friends, where the Master still comes and meets with His brethren. And a place where a man still comes and tells me all things that ever I did. And a place that I can come and see Him over and over and over again.
May it always be said of this place that there is a name here that these people fear the Lord. These people are the friends of God. And these are people who walk with Him. I know He walks with us in thick and thin, but may we walk with Him in thick and thin. May we hold fast unto Him who holds fast unto us. And may we rejoice all the days of our life in what He has done, what He is doing, and what He'll one day do for us. May the Lord bless you, is my prayer. We're going to stand together and sing a song in conclusion. Publish an open door of the church. If there's one more here that would like to join the church, that's fun that he's singing.